Support for WERU comes from the Spectrum Generations Muskie Center in Waterville and the Kennebec Montessori School in Fairfield, presenting David Mallet in concert on Sunday, March 11th, starting at 2 p.m. at the Williamson Auditorium in Fairfield. More information at 873-4745 or kennebecmontessori.org.
It's 10 o'clock and you are tuned to WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online everywhere at WERU.org. Writers Forum with your host Ellie O'Leary is up next.
Welcome to Writers Forum, a program that brings the voices of Maine's own writers here to join with WERU's many voices. I'm Ellie O'Leary, your host this morning for Writers Forum. Our guests today are three women who write mostly poetry, Jane Eagles, Carolyn Gelland, and Gail Van Wart. Our first reader today is Jane Eagles, who takes great pains to tell me she is not an officially published poet. Although, unless we count her high school literary magazine and later, small booklets of prayer poems written for her Sunday school students. However, in the fall of 2007, she began compiling poems she'd write on her daily walks with her dog, Chester. These walks along the same 2-mile round-trip route now have spawned about 500 poems, many of which are accompanied by photos taken of the scenes that inspired the words. She writes of the same landscape, seen from different perspectives, at different times of day and night, in different weather, and in different seasons. She is calling this compilation In This Moment, and describes these poems as not only what my eyes see, but what my heart does also. What will you be reading for us today, Jane?
I'll be reading some poems that introduce you to my dog, Chester, and then as we walk, what I see and what I feel. And at the very end, I'd like to share two writings about aging, one from the perspective of a parent and one from a child. Routine. My day starts with a shower in the pre-dawn light, before I carry my dog downstairs to start the day. Or if it's too dark to carry him safely, he waits, then comes plopping down the stairs himself when he hears me lift the lid of the margarine container for my breakfast muffin. I then stoke the wood stove, put the kettle on for my workday thermos of tea, grab my yogurt and some granola, and sit down for a few moments of quiet in the still silent house, with my dog at my feet, as we listen to the crackle of the wood stove, watch its glow, and together commune with the dawning day. It's just a few moments, but at this time, the day and the world is just ours. As light begins to peak, slowly over the horizon, and the day begins. Harmony, 6 a.m., and not yet first light, though my dog and I are already out and about for our morning's exploration. It's a time of day, not yet knowing what it will become, quiet and anticipating. It's a wonderful time to be out and about, companioned by my dear friend, as we each breathe in the scent of the awakening dawn, and breathe out the harmony of our being together, greeting this day. Don't you know that? My dog's in a mood. He doesn't want to go for his walk. So when I tag at his collar, he slips it, then stands there looking at me, not running away, just standing there and looking, as if to say, "What part are you not getting? I want to go back home and go on to my bed and sleep the morning away. It's too early to get up. Don't you know that?" My protector. An unaccustomed plastic bag sits by the roadside, and as we near it, my dog begins to stalk. First somewhat uncertain, and somewhat unsure of what tack to take. Then nearer, courage building with each step. Hair standing up on end on his back, a low growl in his throat. Attack mode, ready to pounce. But then, a slight breeze ruffles the bag, extinguishing confidence and calling for retreat. He looks to me as I inch forward, closer, befriending the terrible monster, flattening the bag, and my protector's fear. Movement. Planted, my dog's 4 feet brace against the pull on his leash as he steadfastly refuses to put his nose out into the morning's raindrops. Skunked. Arriving home to the stench of your confrontation, I could only imagine the shock and awe of your confusion when the little black and white kitty cat you'd cornered turned to stand its ground and greeted you with its odoriferous perfume. Skunked, you certainly were. And now on our walks. Autumn's flowers. The vibrant greens of summer are less brilliant now as they deepen into the early chill of fall that is still yet a month or so away on the calendar. The air, too, feels different, heavier, less playful, less expectant. While shadows sink lower and lower on the horizon, summer is not yet gone, though it hints of its brevity in the blossoms of goldenrod lit by the morning sun along the roadside. Autumn's flowers, signaling summer's advancing end. Those yet to be. Smoky-colored frosted leaves lie waiting for the sun to warm them and melt the icy coffins now encasing them. Though fallen, their life cycle still depends upon changes in temperature and weather to transform them back into the rich earth they will become that will go on to nurture their brothers and sisters in the next season of life. A cycle played out time and time again by those who have passed away, nurturing those yet to be. Sea smoke morning. Sea smoke blankets the bay as the temperature on the porch shows -2 degrees, and that's without registering the wind chill factor. So my dog and I bundled up, but not without my first lathering up his paws with musher's wax, like the sled dogs use, to keep his feet from freezing to the ground. It's the kind of day when your nostrils freeze together, when you breathe, and when your eyes tear just from the cold. But it's beautiful out, and when we return from our walk, the warmth of the wood stove's fire will be there to greet us. I know, because I just put a log on to burn. Time on vacation. The houses are empty now, and the summer people gone for the season. The porch furniture turned upside down, and through the windows, life is left as it was until next year's return. Funny, the echoes of people left by their surroundings, each a story of summer and of the joys of time away on vacation. Green pastures. Foggy-eyed and with my brain still muddled from sleep, I step out into the warm sunlight, soft, before the day's heat turns it up. Out into a world tinkling with birdsong and tender breezes greeting the day, and with no one in sight except me and my dog and our own private world to treasure and enjoy and be thankful for. While elsewhere, across the world, the backdrop to the day is blazing guns, explosions, and death, or blistering sun and drought, with there the grim reaper silent in descent. What separates me from those over there? Why are they there and me here? Why do two worlds exist, with me the one here to lie down in green pastures? Why? How little it takes. Patches of roadside trash, thoughtlessly discarded, blight the landscape, reminding me of how little it takes for each of us to destroy the beauty of our planet, and how little it takes for each of us to preserve its gift. And now two poems about aging, a poem and an essay. Becoming invisible. It happens subtly, insidiously, right before your eyes. Yet you don't see it, at least not at first. Then one day it all begins to change. And although you are the same person you were yesterday, other people, I think, and especially your children and their friends, don't see you that way. They begin to see less and less of who you are. You speak, but they don't seem to hear you, or maybe not even want to hear you. They are focused on their lives and the lives of their children and their friends. What happens in your life seems of little consequence, unless it begins to infringe on theirs, your health, your finances, your impending burden to them. Though they will gladly tell you all about the events of their lives, the excitement and energy which once filled yours, but which now they seem to think only they have exclusive possession of. What you do and what you think seems relegated to another time, without a place in their lives of today. They seem to want you when they need you for something, but the rest of the time you are out there somewhere, waiting for the next chance to be part of their lives, the lives that you brought into this world, but which in reality they seem to have forgotten or never really understood. So you become invisible long before the time when it becomes your time to do so. P.S. You gave them roots, you gave them wings, and now they have flown away without you.
Before you read the essay, I just I want to say that I already knew that you live right on Penobscot Bay. You can see the water from your front porch, but I thought that's going to come out in the poetry. I don't need to say it, and it's wonderful. And what our listeners can't see is that Jane has a wonderful book here with a photo and a poem and a photo and a poem, and it's a marvelous. I'll hold it up so you can hear it. And the aging is wonderful, but I know this. I've heard this essay. Oh, actually, I have heard this essay. And I didn't mean to interrupt, but please, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Hussy red nail polish. Hussy red nail polish. That's what my mom called it, as I held her feet and polished her toenails, in this ritual made more palatable by this addition of color. Pruning my mom's toenails had become one of the increasing tasks asked of me due to her advancing age. Like balancing her checkbook and taking her grocery shopping, or when she would let me, shopping there for her myself. The simple tasks of daily living increasingly becoming part of my own. It seemed her way of needing me, as so long ago I needed her to help me through the daily tasks of my growing up. Our roles now reversed, I sometimes bristled at the responsibilities increasingly thrust upon me. After all, it was she who had chosen me to be her child, and not I who had chosen her to be my mother. In the midst of my own life, I was now being asked to be more and more a part of hers, while at the same time, I was also trying to manage my own life and my own family. Mom would call me often, despite our regular scheduled visits, believing for the most part, I think, that I could somehow make things better for her, which is what I did want to do. I wanted to be the one to put a smile on her face, as she had so often done for me, if it just wasn't for that darn pedicure. For some reason, that task unglued me, though I joke about it with her, as we each laughed about the inelegance of one's feet. Then it came, her last pedicure, though I didn't know it at the time. It was her birthday weekend, and I decided to try making her birthday luncheon outing especially festive, even though it included beforehand the dreaded pedicure. That was when Hussy Red came into our lives, transforming both the ritual and me. With her feet again in my hands, I began to look at them in a new way, and in that moment, I recognized the intimacy of touch that up until this point had eluded me. I realized then that for me, touch was and is the most communicative of the senses, expressing all they have realized and even one small gesture. Yes, what I believe now is in the power of touch to transform connection. And I believe in hussy red nail polish.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jane. It's very nice of you to share that with us. You know.
Thank you.
And I should only speak for myself. I certainly appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
In case you are just joining us, you are listening to the Writers Forum with guest writers Jane Eagles, Carolyn Gelland, and Gail Van Wharton. I'm your host, Ellie O'Leary. Carolyn Gelland has published poems in numerous literary journals, including Iodine Poetry Journal, The Bitter Oleander, Southwester, Off the Coast, Grass Limb, and River's Edge. She worked as a translator from Norwegian and ran a small art gallery while living in New York City. After marrying, she and her husband, poet Kenneth Frost, moved to rural Maine to focus on writing poems. She has just this past month published a book of poems entitled Four Alarm House. And will you be reading from, you know, you already explained. Go ahead. I'll
yes,
let you speak.
Ellie.
It's your turn.
Yes, Ellie. I'm looking forward to reading from my own book, but I like to start my readings with a poem of my husband's, Coring the Moon, from his book Night Flight. The full moon has a hole in it, right in the center. If you look closely, you can see a long tunnel and dark creatures traveling through it. Then they drop out of sight. Do they fall into a trap, a black hole, or nothing? Coyotes run in circles, mad for the nothing of the moon. They try on their ghosts in the moon's dressing room. Owls become raucous and tear their spirits limb from limb. The hole passes with a long howl, and men and raccoons and deer come out of the woods, moonstruck. From my own book, Four Alarm House, I'll start with a poem called Duet with Gabriel for Louis Armstrong. Kenneth told me lots of stories about Louis Armstrong, one that he was playing a command performance for the King of England, and he gestured up to the royal box. This one's for you, Rex, before he played it. And later on, when he got old and sick and the doctor said he shouldn't play his horn anymore, Louis said, I gotta play my horn, Doc. When I die, I'm gonna play a duet with Gabriel. He loves his horn the way I do. A man's gotta have something he can die for. Duet with Gabriel. He finds the rhythm. A grape seed dancing in a glass of champagne. He plays a duet with Gabriel. This one's for you, Rex. Exaltation of the air, sunshine ransacks shining ground. Each note gets rich on the next. The next poem is Forgotten. The bones of the dead sparkle deeper and deeper into darkness. Sometimes a sleeper rises, bones clothed in a sort of lantern, and stands at the edge of life. My next poem is a tribute to the great German poet Hölderlin, who lived from 1770 to 1843. He said that he was struck by Apollo, and I know he was. Hölderlin was a poet of praise. I consider him, therefore, to be the modern equivalent of Pindar, his sense of the world blazing with God. The corollary to that is that he could also express in a profound and suffering way the experience of the withdrawal of God from the world. I love his modernity, his intense and gnomic fragments, his etymologies. But this is my poem,
for Huldolin. I have thoughts whose witnesses are ready to be put to death. There must be no sleeping during that time. My lamp, a fakir, drones hollow music to my black, radiant skull. I am interested in desperation. I float and fly in it. The clouds are casual coffins. The boatman rips their bellies open and drinks tears. He cannot enter my house. There is no outside to it, as my left hand cannot cover my right without moving out of space. I am inside listening. The song in the wind changes its tone in every tree. White ravens sink through the stars, dress and undress the silence. I sit in the open spaces of my heart, crumble a handful of words. The next poem is called Afterward. There are no pockets in the cerement sea, and the great bear glitters his chainmail in the sky. Someone's oars stumble in a send of harrowing hands, while the moon silvers the flesh that will perish him. Fish lie in wait in the tents of the waves. They close their eyes to the desideration that mans the boat that rises on stilts, to the uninhabited mask of anguish that tolls and entombs the words. I am your friend. I am poor and come to you. I am poor. That is why I am hunting you. I have a question. I do not know what it is. Edvard Munch, the great Norwegian painter, we all know his great painting, The Scream. Edvard Munch had an interesting observation. I'm quoting him now. Without illness and anxiety, I would have been like a rudderless ship. This is my poem for Edvard Munch. He chatted with the buzzing deep in his ears in sentences that came further and further forward where miracles occurred. I remember Munch's studio. The paintings slept like animals on the barn floor. If he groaned, he would walk on them or stick them outside in the snow. When he had gone, a lifelong scream spun on the four walls like a saint's lariat. The next poem is about Helen of Troy. It's called Helen. You are all this in your beauty's apocalyptica. You turn the sky into a painter's house, all his canvases on display. But drifting between the garden's green three columns, rafting late light, the wind sighs at your coming, sensing the far horses. I'll read the poem that opens the book, Wild Cat. How many years now has the wild cat sat by my fire, seven moons in her eyes, the wind kneeling at the door in furious adoration, while Tintoretto's angels purr at the flickering mirror of her milk, snowing all those faces. Someone asked me what Tintoretto's angels look like, and they look like filaments of light, enormous vortices, like the snow devils that blow across our fields in the winter. I'll follow that with Viking raid. Blood angels whip through the waves like water snakes. High, proud, spiked beards shear the air. Battle axes honed on winter's shrieking flint, twirl like spindles in hammer hands. Woolen sails dip their wings as they near land. Two young moons, shrouded in mist, spring with yellow eyes. Inebriate pause. Inebriate pause, whisk through winter trees. A menagerie of shadows springs to life. What streamlined body raids your mind for loot as you grow into your animal, the restless saddle of your spirit? Ellie, do I have time for one new one that's not in the book?
Absolutely, sure.
This one will be in the next book. Gravity. I smile across the luncheon tablecloth, wrinkling my thought on the magician's silk of gravity. Yes, I know which formulas blossom under the barbed wire and cancellation marks of suffering. They whistle like hooks talking to fish.
Thank you. Thank you. You give me so many questions. So many questions. And we'll have a little bit of a discussion on the whole process after each person has read. But in Edvard Munch, you talked about the lifelong scream.
Yes.
And, you know, don't want to start an argument, but I think that scream lasted a little longer than a lifetime.
Yes, I agree. It's an eternal one, isn't it?
Right.
Yes.
Yes. It's the first painting I ever heard.
Yes. He was walking along the road, and the fjord was on one side, and the rocks were reflecting the sunset, and everything seemed covered with blood, and he thought of that painting.
Right. And I think there are four versions, actually.
Yes.
I'm no Norwegian expert. I've noticed you translated from the Norwegian.
Yes.
Can say I've never done that. Not likely to. Certainly Munch is a favorite of, it would be like, oh, he's one of my favorites. Oh, he's just about a lot of people's favorite.
Oh, yes.
Right. Thank you so much. You are listening to Writer's Forum on WERU-FM. I'm your host, Ellie O'Leary. And our third reader today is Gail Van Wart. Gail earned her first writing award for a Humane Society essay while in the third grade, though she hardly thought about becoming a writer at that time. Now she says she feels driven to write on purpose, not by assignment, because she just plain wants to write. Can't think of a better reason. She is the steward of the family blueberries at Peaked Mountain Farm and the author of Life Raked In, a book of poetry, thoughts, and recipes raked in from the wild blueberry field. Go ahead, Gail.
Okay, thank you so much, Ellie, for having me on the show and giving me an opportunity to meet these wonderful ladies here and to be a part of sharing some poetry. My book, Life Raked In, as she said, is basically written because I wanted to get the clutter that's been on my desk, and some of them have been in anthologies and everything. It's my time in life to put things in order. And I look at life and nature around me. I see in the field a cycle of life, and it's true in everything. And in the blueberry field, it starts with a new bloom. Every cycle of life starts in its own spring with the birth of life's new blooms. Springtime in Maine is filled with the buzzing of love songs. The birds are singing too, but the bees are singing across the state as they pollinate the wild blueberry fields, which have been a part of Maine's natural environment for over 14,000 years. It reminds us that the very nature of things is woven into our past intricately and yet simply, and the fabric of our futures. And so that inspires me to write about nature. And one of the things I wrote was called The Nature of Things. The wind cries hysterically as sun rays sear the earth, and tides thunder in a pall as it dumps remnants of better times on Earth's decaying shores. Funny how these elements remain so strong in spite of our best efforts to destroy our natural habitat. And then, of course, after the new bloom, there's the growth. And as while blueberry blossoms transform into their fruit, the struggle of growth begins. Challenges are ever present in the wild blueberry fields, as they are in our daily journey from infancy to maturity. Growth is a time of coping, adapting, and learning how to overcome whatever tries to hinder it. And as a mother, I'm sure anyone who has raised any children can relate to this part of growth. And it's called, I Can Only Hope. Yes, yes, I know. You're not my baby anymore. In fact, I know you're almost a man who'll soon depart my door. So you ask me why I even bother to try to bring you up anymore. You feel you're treated like a helpless pup and wish that I would just give up. Yes, I know you think I'm your greatest foe on earth and that everything I say to you is nagging without worth. Even though I have never taught you wrongs or scolded you for doing right, I've never offered you harmful drugs or challenged you to a fight. No, you won't be a child much longer, and when your mind is stronger, you will understand why I don't say to hell with it and wash you off my hands. You see, even if I cannot make you practice what I preach, or even listen to the lessons I constantly try to teach, I can still hope that you will learn enough. I can hope that you will be just bright enough to win a battle without your fist and secure enough to laugh at jest. For the day that I can see you are just good enough to breed a little integrity into the human race and are capable of forgiving grace, I'll unleash you. I won't expect you to be perfect when you depart. I can only hope you'll be just perfect enough not to break your own heart when you find yourself still a puppy in a dog-eat-dog world.
Yeah, that's all we can hope. The old roots and wings.
And that's right. And you go from growth to the harvest in the blueberry field, and we all reap what we sow in this world. And you never know at the beginning of a crop cycle what the harvest will yield. The final tally can only come after all the wild blueberries have been raked in. Sometimes we're happy with the numbers, other years we aren't. But as one harvest ends, we file its data away to refer to as we look beyond it and start to prepare for the next cycle, applying lessons learned from the past to the prospects of a future crop. And this is a fairly recent poem, as you can tell by its title, Wall Street Blues. They gather like clusters of blueberries on a stem, bunching together to form a healthy array of diverse varieties in the field. As they grow, their rhizomes spread across the land, reaching for nourishment to feed their existence. Another crowd, resembling foxes watching a hen house, feasts on harvests stolen from the fields, thinking they control this nation's crops and yields. Yet the crop newly planted but firmly rooted on Wall Street feeds upon a far more sustainable and organic fertilizer in which to grow a nation of equality. Whether you are left, right, independent, or wrong, you cannot deny our nation is singing for a just harvest.
Oh, yes. Singing indeed. Yes, yes.
And then, of course, we come to the end of a cycle in a blueberry field, but all cycles must complete one full circle of life before another cycle can begin. In the wild blueberry fields, we complete it with the pruning of the plants, which were harvested so we can again see a bloom, grow fruit, and provide a healthy harvest. And so it is with everything. And as I say nature is poetry, and poetry is nature, and life in itself is a poem. So I entitled this one Sweet Immortal Poem. Song of the soul, treasure of the heart, flow gracefully from the mind in colorful imitation of rainbows, drenched in the sun and rain of life. Lift up on gentle rhythms of rhyme, arching your pages of thought to reflect your inclinations into prisms of awareness to be reflected again and again throughout the sweet immortal chapters of time.
Oh, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now,
have I used my time?
You're fine.
Well, that's
I just
all
said
I had
you to
planned.
Be polite.
I had all that. Those are the ones I had planned for you. And
No, you're doing well. This book, I've never had anybody do this, but this book has recipes.
Yes.
Maine's Fabulous Wild Blueberry Cake. Peaked Mountain Farms Chilled Wild Blueberry Soup.
Ooh. Mm. That is really good, too. It is. It's an unusual recipe, but it's good, and it's cold, so you can actually make it like a head and then just bring it out and garnish it before serving. So it's sort of...
I'm not much of a garnisher, but that sounds good. I like this one, Gail's Wild Blueberry Gingerbread. Oh, I make a cream sauce when I make gingerbread. That is a recipe my father, who is from Ireland, really liked. And I thought, I think I might have a new gingerbread recipe.
Oh, I'm sure you will.
So this is wonderful. I wanted to talk with each of you a little bit about the books that you have or what you're working on. For instance, Carolyn, I know that you have been published in a number of literary journals.
Yes.
And so some of our listeners might wonder, if it was published there, can you still put it in a book? And how do you do that?
Oh, yes, Ellie. It's very important to have a number of credits from literary journals to buttress your manuscript when you present it to a publisher. It's a very good idea to send out your poems in small groups and see how they fare in this world, and then collect them for your book when you're ready.
But you retain the rights.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, when they're published in a small literary magazine, you retain the rights.
Yes.
And then you give publishing credits in the book?
Yes, I do.
And when you put, your book is called Four Alarm House, and when you put it together, how many poems are there? Maybe about 50?
Is it? 40-odd.
Yeah?
40-odd.
And so you assemble them in an order to make it a manuscript, not a list of poems, I assume?
I try, Ellie, to cluster constellations of poems. This word or this theme or tone will lead to another. And it seems to develop in that manner.
And the book is titled Four Alarm House. So there's a title poem. You didn't happen to read that one. But how did you come up with the title?
Well, when Kenneth and I moved to Maine in 1997, we were here for 6 happy months, and then the ice storm occurred, and our generator caught fire, and our house and barn burned, and we lost 2,000 books. And it was a four-alarm house. That experience seemed to encapsulate a number of other experiences that I've had. And I think my poems, many of them, describe an urgent state.
That would be urgent.
Yeah.
Especially after it would be like 2,000 books.
Yes. And for the first time, we had thought when we moved from the city, an apartment that didn't
wasn't right. big enough any longer for our books, mm-hmm. that now we would spread them out.
Right.
And mm-hmm. we lost quite a few, but we replaced them rather quickly. We escaped from the house with our poems and our books and each other.
Always escape with your poems.
Yes.
When in
yes,
doubt, escape yes, with your poems.
Yes, we did. But even after that terrible experience, we found Maine the perfect place in which to work. Mm-hmm. As we said in the back of Kenneth's book, we came up to Maine to work in a solitude we could only dream about in New York City. And it has right. proved to be very productive.
You have to sort of make your solitude anywhere, but more so in yes. a large city.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And Jane, your book I know is not published, and it's the In the Moment.
Mm-hmm.
It is just a wonderful compilation. I've yes. talked to Jane about this before. This will be published because I'm like that. I'm going to make sure she publishes it. But it will be, if not a coffee table book, I'm saying at least an end table book, you know.
Because, definitely.
Yeah, photographs.
Because yes. it will have to include the pictures and the poetry, and it's such a rich, diverse mm-hmm. bit of writing, and you're a great photographer. You know, if you go any place with Jane, be prepared. You know,
I have my camera just in case.
Yeah, she always has her camera just in case, just in case. But it's wonderful to see, and I know that it's a work in progress and isn't everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
yes.
Walt Whitman. He, you know, if he hadn't died, he'd still be rewriting Leaves of Grass. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the only thing that stopped him. I mean, I have no idea how many editions there were, but a lot. And it was never finished.
Revision is everything.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So, you know, at some point I'm going to say to her, that's it.
Oh, that's Kenneth it. Would always quote mm-hmm. Something by Paul Valéry. A poem is never finished. It is only abandoned.
Oh.
Eventually, we have to abandon our poems.
Mm-hmm. Right. You have to give them, you know, right. once again, we're back to the roots and wings.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yes.
You have to give your poetry a chance to be a poem on its own
yes.
and attract whosoever it will. You
yes.
know?
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you might include recipes, Gail.
That's right. Uh-huh. Well, you know, these blueberries are... Mm-hmm. are you know, they inspire the poetry. They inspire a lot of things in my life. And the recipes, the things that we eat, you know, it's become wonderful. And as I said earlier, first of all, I grew up with these blueberries around me. And at that time when I was growing up, it was no big deal.
Exactly.
Maine blueberries were nothing, you know, to...
I grew up in Maine. I raked blueberries
yeah,
as a kid.
Yeah, and we thought mm-hmm. nothing of them, and I mm-hmm. took it for granted in 2002 when it became my job to manage these blueberries, and I started realizing, the rest of the world started realizing what a wonderful superfruit they are and all the mm-hmm. good benefits.
All the antioxidants.
Exactly. I felt mm-hmm. like, my God, I'm sitting here in this, you know, I've been blessed.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything I am stems from these blueberries. I grew up there, and now I've returned to these blueberries, and I'll pass these blueberries on to somebody else, and in all ways.
And being as involved as you are with them, you certainly have to be caught in the seasons.
Right.
I mean, we all are more caught in the seasons. Even people like, oh, I live in the city, I don't farm anything. People who live in the cities tend to be caught in the school year seasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people's lives don't generally go from January 1st to, you know, if you do taxes,
that's true.
You know, you have the tax season. It may be not a naturally occurring event, but, you know, it's the yeah. seasons. But you must really notice the seasons because some years you, yeah. well, do you plant? You don't actually plant.
You,
they come
you
up
know,
again.
No, they've been growing. They're part of our natural environment. Mm-hmm. And we just... mine the blueberries. We
right.
don't plant them. We or cultivate them. We
do you,
mine them. We take care of them.
I think this is a reasonable question. Do you burn the bushes in the fall?
That's one way of pruning. Right. Another way is mowing, and they're starting to do more mowing than pruning, but actually it was the Native Americans that taught the white settlers about burning and pruning the blueberries to turn it into a harvestable fruit. And Maine and Eastern Canada are the only places really that it's commercially harvested, this wild natural fruit.
Right, they're smaller than, what I know is, I mean, they're smaller than what you might get like in the supermarket.
Right.
Well, you can get them in the supermarket
in
season.
Right. You drive by the blueberry fields coming here and with all the rock and everything.
I did, and they were burned, and that's what made me ask the question. They burned them.
That's one way. And that, especially if you have diseases, you have to. There's little things that we'll know to come back and attack those blueberries again, but if you burn it, it will take away spores or eggs from
giving the
from
bush a fever.
Insects. Yes.
Hmm?
I've learned to, I wouldn't have known this before 2002. I wouldn't have cared, you know.
Even though you grew up there, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
But I
joke now because I grew up in Waldo County, and many people know that, you know, Belfast is a lovely town and has fantastic Gothic architecture. Never noticed. How, you know, like, really? That was always there.
I think we have to remove ourselves sometimes and then come back to rediscover what we really are. And I think that's another part of what helped me to appreciate what I have is from traveling around the world to different places and coming back and seeing what a beautiful place this is. And
finding out how much it does depend upon, like a red wheelbarrow, how much it does depend upon a blueberry.
That's right. That's right.
Ellie, you mentioned you never noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think of my writing the poems of walking the same route every day, every day I see something different that I did not see the day before.
Yeah.
It's
and
there.
And not just plastic bags, things that are there all
the
time.
They're there.
Trees.
Okay. But how it looks, you know, the weather, what time of day it is, what season it is, it's the same route.
Yeah.
But it is always new if we look.
Yeah.
And that's the point that really inspires me to not just on my walk, but in life in general.
Yeah.
Pay attention. Okay.
Yeah. I think if writers, you know, besides all the things, we work alone and we're lonely and all that sort of stuff, you know, writers also have the advantage that we pay attention more. That we notice things. And I think that's part of the reason that memoir has become so popular is because you're getting to read things from people who paid attention. You know, of course, I'll go on my little kick that autobiography is the story of your life. And autobiographies are not that popular right now. Memoir is the story about something about your life.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't, I was born here, I was, you know, I lived here and here. It isn't. It isn't your Facebook timeline, you know. The memoir is something about something in your life, like a memoir about returning to the farm.
Yes.
You know, I write stories about growing up in Freedom, Maine. And memoirs are about something. And the advantage is writers notice. And so now they've started to take on, there's like so many places for essays to go out, so many places to read, and memoirs have taken on such a popularity because they aren't the whole long thing, and then I did this, and then I did that, and then we moved here. It's not about that. It's about noticing something you collect. Please help me collect coffee mugs. Jane has been to my house. I have a few. It'd be a little more than a few, you know. But I could write an essay about each one.
Yes.
I haven't because I have places to go and things to do. But I could. And I actually do think about it sometimes, you know. And that's what makes memoir so popular. And then again, poetry is people who notice and really make note. And really put it into something, like, of course you notice that your house burned down, you know. But to really put the image into just the right words, that's the difference between just having it happen, my house burned down, and it was a four-alarm house, you know. And it's just so wonderful to be able to share all of the your experiences, you know, as you ladies express them in poetry, but just to share with writers is just fabulous, you know. Now, in one of your poems, Carolyn, I was paying attention. I also have the book in front of me, so I have that advantage. But I will get to it. There was something at a quote in the end, and I didn't know. It was the poem afterward.
Oh, yes.
And it says, I am your friend. I am poor and come to you. I am poor. That is why I am hunting you. I have a question. I do not know what it is.
Yes.
Where's the quote from?
Well, the quote comes from several places. Let me just see what page that's
43.
On. 43. The Eskimos had and have such respect for the animals they're hunting. Mm-hmm. And they address the animals they're hunting with words like this. I am your friend. I am poor and come to you. I am poor. That is why I am hunting you. They say that to the animal. They show the animal great respect. The second part of that quote, I have a question, I do not know what it is, was uttered by my sister after she lost her first child in stillbirth. Mm. And one evening she just said, I have a question, I do not know what it is.
And that expresses such a frustration.
Yeah. You know, that, I was haunted for years by that question, and I knew that someday I would use it in a poem.
Yeah. That brings me to process, you know, speaking of your writing process, where do you keep those snippets, those things that you haven't used yet? Don't tell me just in my head, because they're really hard to find there. At least in my head they are, you know.
I have a great many notebooks. Mm-hmm. I have a great many scraps. Mm-hmm. I try to keep an immaculate house, but my scraps are everywhere. Mm-hmm.
An immaculate house is overrated.
Yes, I think so too. But I have notes all over the place, stray pieces of paper. The other day, I was working on a revision of a poem. I could not think of what to do in a certain place. And I think this was a miracle. I got up, I saw a piece of paper on the floor, unrelated to what I was working on. I picked it up, and on that little scrap
of course,
were the words I needed,
exactly what you needed.
For that poem. Mm-hmm. Kenneth always spoke about chasing words in orbit. And I like that description.
I do. And where do you keep your snippets, Jane?
I write them down right away when I, like when I'm walking. It's in my head, mm-hmm. and I have to get it down on a piece of paper as soon as I can so that it doesn't get lost, that it doesn't go off into the nether.
That's right.
And,
Jane uses the Mary Oliver method of walking and writing and taking notes. And she gets shy when I mention that, but that's what Mary Oliver does. She walks. She comes back, makes notes, and writes poetry.
Yes.
So there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. My process. Mm-hmm.
And you have these little tiny notebooks, I noticed.
Yes. I also write small. So.
Jane writes very small. So her notebooks are so small that her handwriting is the appropriate size.
Mm-hmm. You know, perfect.
My handwriting on a little notebook is like, okay, three words on a page.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Mm-hmm. And Gail, where do you?
Everywhere. I have like boxes and trunks and and I will pull out things every once in a while. And the funny thing is, I will pick up things that I have written before, and I'll pick it up and read it, and I'll go, who did that? You know, I don't even, you know, it's like I'm reading somebody else's words sometimes. But like with Jane, when you're thinking of something, you have to put it down somewhere. Thank God for iPhones now. I've got lots of little notes.
Oh, I actually keep notes on my iPhone too. I do.
Because it's kind of with you. But at nighttime, I will think of things, and if I don't write them down, I won't remember them in the morning. And or if I'm riding along somewhere, all these things go through your head. I wish I could just tap into it and like stream it into a notepad from my mind. Because
I keep a notebook next to my bed, and I actually sometimes wake up writing. Mm-hmm. I'll be working on an essay as I'm waking up, and I think, well, I have to get this down, you know, before I start walking around, make a cup of coffee, and wash it away, you know. Yes. But I keep my my snippets in file folders on my computer. I can be a little bit anal about some things, not my housekeeping, but my my snippets, you know, they're pretty well organized, you know. Now, for each of you, I know. In order to see Jane's book, you have to track down Jane.
Yeah.
But for your husband's book, Night Flight, and for your book, For Alarm House, where could people find
those? Yes, they can go to www.mainstreetrag.com, or they can go to Devaney Doken Garrett in Farmington, and the number is 778-3454. For Kenneth's book, they can go to Amazon. Mine isn't on there yet. It's too new, but it will be on, I guess.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And we might mention, I'll say it, I know that it's hard, but I know that Kenneth passed away last year.
Yes, he did. But
his poetry.
Yes, and I have his second manuscript ready. And a third, I believe, but the second one is ready.
Oh.
So that will be coming out. I don't know quite when.
And
but
Where to Find Each of You will be archived on our website.
Great.
So I fill out a form when I get to it, which will be later today, I
yes.
promise.
Yes.
And you will be, our listeners will be able to find that. Now, your book, Life Raked In, love the title, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
It's I've raked blueberries, I know. Where can people find your book?
You can find it at Sherman's in Bar Harbor, Blue Hill Books, Bookstacks, Briar Patch in Bangor, on Amazon.com, and my website is store.biteoblue.com. And also... I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I'm not good
at
that.
Out of the Blue.
The Gulf of Maine Books in Brunswick.
And don't you have a website called Out of the Blue?
I do have. Mm-hmm. You can go to my Facebook page or to Life Raked In on Facebook, and you can find all the information there as well.
Okay. I'll put it all in the form, and anybody looking can find that. People may want those blueberry recipes. You
I
never
hope
know.
So.
Okay. For the past hour, you have been listening to the Writers Forum. Thanks to our guest, Jane Eagles, Carolyn Gelland, and Gail Van Wart for being here this morning and sharing their work with us. Thanks also to our engineer, Amy Brown. Next month, we will have a group from Unity College working in collaboration with Off the Coast magazine. So that's going to be something different for us, and we're quite excited to have that happen. I don't know how many people will be here. Please be sure to listen to WERU on the second Thursday of every month from 9 to 11 a.m. Also streaming live on www.weru.org, where all of our Writers Forum shows are archived, as this one will be. If you would like to present your work, published or unpublished, please notify the station. Call WERU at 469-6600 during business hours, or send an email to info@weru.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions, but most of all, we want to say thank you for listening on the second Thursday of every month at 10 a.m.
In Maine, about 15% of our people worry consistently about having enough income to pay for food or otherwise provide food.